we're very pleased to welcome a guest back onto the studio whom we had the other week, Dr. Adrian Webb, who's head of archive at the Hydrographic Office in Taunton. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning to you, Pauline.
It's lovely to see you again, and thank you for coming in all the way from the big city of Taunton to talk on 10 Radio, because we are going. Last time we were together, we were speaking about different topics and the Natural History Society and history specifically, but we're going to talk about the Hydrographic Office and what it entails and how wonderful a resource it is. But tell us, your head of archive, which for such an old establishment as the Hydrographic Office is quite a massive title. It's a sort of, bit of a scary role, I would have thought, to be in charge of all that fantastic resource.
Well, yes, it can be a bit daunting at times, because our archive collection actually goes back to the 1620s, and our oldest document is a survey of the Portsmouth area that's actually drawn on animal skin. It's very fragile.
Wow.
It's all hand-drawn. It's hand-coloured. It's very, very detailed. And it is one of our many treasures.
Goodness. And it's survived all these years, even though it's animal skin and therefore organic. And you'd have thought it could have almost rotted.
Well, yes. This is the strange thing that we like to talk to our visitors when they come round and we show them this document, that actually, although it's 400 years old, it will probably be still here, hopefully still be here, in another 400 years' time, whereas all of the faxes and papers and plastics that we've used for the last 20, 30, 40 years, sadly
Fade
won't
and
be.
Disappear.
They will be gone. And even, of course, some of the electronic data has a tendency to disappear if it's not looked after.
Do you know who made that plan, that map?
No, we have no idea. Unfortunately, it's not signed and it's actually not dated. So it's actually been dated by some of the evidence that's on the map or chart, depending on how you look at it. But it was in a manor house near Southampton for 200 years. And then in the early 1800s, when the Hydrographic Office was collecting anything relating to water and maps and charts and surveys, somebody very kindly donated it, and there is some provenance written on the document that shows the name of the person who gave it. And in those early years, a lot of information came in through donations from naval officers and people who knew that the office had just been established and wanted to give information, maritime information and navigational information, into a sort of central repository that could be used by the British Navy.
So tell us, going back to its very beginnings, when did the Hydrographic Office begin?
Okay, so there's an interesting story behind all of this. In 1720, the French had a Hydrographic Office, a government Hydrographic Office. And normally, as is the British way of things, we normally copy a lot of things that the French do quite quickly. But it took us until 1795 to actually establish an office. And it was all done through the Privy Council. It was approved by King George III. And there were many attempts before 1795 to have a Hydrographic Office in Great Britain, but they all came to nothing through various different reasons.
Why is that? Because we're such a maritime nation, or we were.
Wow.
Why did it just take us so long?
It's a difficult one. A type of office, a sort of a function of a Hydrographic Office, was even suggested in the late 17th century by Great Britain's first naval royal hydrographer, which was a man called Captain Grenville Collins. And we have 25 of his hand-drawn surveys in our collection. And for some reason, you know, it just didn't happen. The ideas were there, but the government, maybe it was a political thing, and they decided, no, we didn't need one, because there was a burgeoning private chart trade that were issuing their own charts.
Okay, so... You know,
so why did the government need to do it as well?
Yes.
And maybe there wasn't the will. I think one of the main reasons it did happen in 1795 was due to the persistence of a man called Alexander Dalrymple, He was a Scotsman. He was a fellow of the Royal Society. He was also a keen golfer. Mm. But his main interest was, of course, charting and navigation. And he worked as hydrographer for the Honourable East India Company.
So was he the Dalrymple family? So William Dalrymple, now the writer on all things subcontinent, and so on, who I know is from an illustrious family. Is it the same family?
It probably is. Dalrymple of Stair.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was really a man ahead of his time. And he was a great collector. And a lot of his charts, they went into the archive in 1795 when he was appointed as the first hydrographer to the Admiralty Board. Mm. And a lot of his atlases that he had collected were donated after his death to the Admiralty, and they formed part of the Hydrographic Office library. It was a very grand library at one stage, but unfortunately the library grew so much that it actually became separated from the Hydrographic Office. Mm. And remained in London when the Hydrographic Office eventually moved away. But fortunately, things come round again, and through the good offices of former curator Ken Atherton, the collection that Dalrymple had bequeathed to the Admiralty actually came back to the Hydrographic Office.
But up until quite recently, therefore, it was still sitting in London in the Admiralty.
It was, yeah. So it went from the Admiralty, it came to Taunton for about 10 years, I think.
Yes.
And now it's gone back to the Admiralty Library, who are now in Portsmouth. So that's moved around. Mm. And also the archive from 1795, when it was officially established, has also moved 7 times.
That many times? No, I didn't know that. So tell us about the locations, therefore, of the hydrographic, because I think most people might know that it was in Bracknell?
Cricklewood.
Right, so I mean, it's been sort of all over.
Moved around. Okay, let me go through the chronology. Yes. So, obviously, in 1795, when we were established, it was in London, in the Admiralty. And by the 1820s, they found that they were running out of space. They obviously hadn't been given enough rooms. And the hydrographer at the time was a man called Captain William Parry, who was best known for his Arctic explorations and his search for the Northwest Passage. And Parry basically wrote to the Lord High Admiral, who was later King William IV, to say, you know, we need more room, we need to do lots of changes in the office, please can you support us? And he did. And so the archive was given some new rooms. But then things didn't go that well politically, and the office, they tried to restrain the office. But as regarding the archive and its moves, in 1923, we went to Cornwall House, which is also in London. And then, of course, in 1939, the war came along, and the office had to move very quickly. Mm. And obviously, lots of London departments had to move out of London.
Fled the capital, yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And we were very fortunate that the Hydrographic Office found a home in Bath, where a lot of other Admiralty offices were. And the Royal School was chosen as the location for the staff who drew the charts and also for the archive. Now, it sounds very good, but unfortunately, unfortunately, we almost had a complete disaster, because the archive was actually located in the school, in the attics. And the attics, of course, they were lined with straw. And of course,
I feel what you're going to say.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The Baedeker raids on Bath, you know, several nights of absolute, devastation. We came very, very close to being hit. There was a machine gun establishment in the school playing fields. And yeah, the building was attacked for some reason, but fortunately survived.
Oh, that's incredible. So, I mean, the building didn't go up with all the straw on the outside.
No, it's still there. It's still there today, and it's still a school.
Yes.
But then shortly after that, also during the wartime, the office moved to Ensley, which was a series of hutments on the outside of Bath. So the archive moved once again.
Mm.
And then when the war was over, they decided that they wanted the drawing staff to go back to London, but not into central London, to Cricklewood. But at the same time this had happened, of course, in June of 1941, a brand new state-of-the-art purpose-built chart-making factory had been opened in Taunton.
By whom?
By the Admiralty. This is the...
There's not much joined-up thinking going
on
here, was
there? It's well documented that the hydrographer of the day, a man called Sir John Edgell, whose family came from Somerset, he actually wanted the drawing staff that were in Bath and the chart production staff that were in Taunton and Exeter and also in London all to be on the one site. It was his dream and vision.
How finally a sensible person seeing the logic of getting it all together.
Indeed, and he actually drew up plans for not only a factory in Taunton, but for offices for the drawing staff as well. And it was rejected, whether it was due to finance, I guess, in the late 1930s.
Or did they want to attract businesses and work back into London post-war?
Well, possibly, yes. That's something I've not really considered. But anyway, so the printing works is opened in June 1941 at Taunton. But going back to the archive, so the archive goes back to London. Okay, so it's in this building in Cricklewood, and it's next door to the one of the British Museum outstores. And there is a story that next to the archive, you could actually, in some of the rooms adjacent, you could actually see all these mummies in this room that were
kept there by the British Museum.
Yeah, all the ones they didn't need to put on show. Yeah. But then in 1968. The next generation of hydrographers, mainly under Rear Admiral Steve Ritchie, who has a local connection to with Liscombe, he persuaded the powers that be that it was really time for the drawing staff, the compilation staff, to move from London down to Taunton. And of course, it was much cheaper to build a new office block in Taunton, and this new office block was named Dalrymple Block after Alexander Dalrymple, and it housed the archive. So the archive came to Taunton in 1968.
Properly for the first time.
There are. So all of the functions of the office were together. But of course, one of the problems the archive has had, because the Hydrographic Office has been so successful in acquiring information, new surveys and charts from different offices around the world, that the archive has just grown and grown and grown. It keeps growing and growing.
And so are you now running out of space?
No. Thanks to the digital world, we've been saved.
Yes.
The torments of having to find a new building or to extend or anything like that. So in the early 2000s, things were really coming to a head space-wise. And then they decided that we should have a new purpose-built archive building. And we are really fortunate that we have a wonderful building. It's on two floors. There is plenty of space, thank goodness. We won't run out of space. And that was opened by HRH, the Duke of York. And it was named after Rear Admiral Ritchie. So we have a Ritchie block.
So the Ritchie block is purely the archive?
Purely the archive,
and yes. Then the new building that's just opened is kind of everything else, administration and
it
all
is,
of that.
Yeah, it is, yeah. It's all of the IT, it's all of the chart compilation, it's all of the marketing and sales, customer service. And
in past years, though, on a visit that we made, it must have been 20 years ago at least, there were still people drawing charts and printing charts, and that the whole space was huge. And the whole digital revolution and so on has altered this entirely now.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And we won't see those people pouring over documents
at all. No, absolutely. And it is... I think people look back with fondness at these things, you know, but things have moved on. And, you know, the office has had a very good reputation for actually moving with the times, for embracing technology, even in the very early years. In the 1820s, we'll go back to the the early period, there was this new technology that was introduced called lithography, obviously printing from stone as opposed to printing from the copper. And, you know, this was something that was tried, and the quality wasn't that good, so it was dropped. But then, you know, a few decades later, when it had been refined and the process had been improved, it was introduced because it was obviously much quicker, and it meant that charts could be produced more efficiently and issued to the mariners so they could use them. And you know, there are many, many examples all throughout our history where new technology has been embraced. And, you know, which used to help the mariner.
Which is the way it goes. Yes, yes. So going right back to the beginnings of the archive and earlier, and I'm looking at a copy of the oldest, not the oldest, almost the oldest document that you have in the archive, but there are some amazingly old and rare and totally unusual charts and information you've got. What are a few of the gems?
A few of the gems. Okay. Well, obviously, probably the biggest single collection of gems I think that we have are those relating to Captain Cook and his discoveries and recordings that he made during those three, you know, world famous voyages. And one of the most famous charts that we do still have that we've retained in the office is the survey of the east coast of Australia, the first time that that's depicted. And it's a wonderful piece of work drawn by Molyneux, and you can see the track of the ship all the way up the coast.
And it's incredibly accurate, I think, isn't it? Indeed. Modern, you know, satellite imaging and God knows what.
His technology that he used for position fixing was, you know, was state of the art at the time, but you know, when you look at it today, it's incredibly crude. But people have done comparisons between his first depiction of New Zealand as two islands, that wonderful hand-drawn chart by Richard Pickersgill, and they've compared it to a modern chart. And you know, considering it's on the other side of the world and he travelled all that distance, the actual shape of the islands and their location is very, very accurate.
Isn't that interesting?
It is really, really a tremendous achievement to have been able to undertake.
Some of
that.
The charts of the east coast of Australia, they then just stop, don't they? I think that, you know, there is no more, that, you know, the land hasn't been surveyed.
That's right. I mean, before Cook was there, the east coast was a bit of an unknown quantity. And that was one of the, you know, reasons that he actually was sent to actually chart these uncharted areas. And another one of our gems that we have, I think I touched on it earlier, were the 25 surveys by Captain Grenville Collins, because those are important for lots of reasons, one of which is because they really are the first government-sponsored surveys, hydrographic surveys of Great Britain, and they date from the 1680s.
Which is ever so long ago. That's incredible.
It is. They were published in 1693, but it was all backed by the Crown. You know, they underwrote the whole survey that took Collins 7 years to undertake. And he, you know, even came to the Bristol Channel, and he went to see Sir Robert Southwell at King's Weston, which is on the north side of the River Avon. And Collins, being a man who seems to be interested in everything, ended up going potholing
Sir
Robert's estate, as you do when you're not hydrographic surveying. You know, do a bit of caving.
Go down on the ground. Yes, yes. Yeah. But people at that time of that level of society were Renaissance people, or they were the lunar men, they were the people who did everything. There was no, you know, restricted sort of discipline, you know, I'm an astronomer or whatever. They did it all. Yep. You know, interested in engines and astronomy and philosophy and potholing and whatever it was. And that's what's fantastic about that period, I think.
Oh, definitely. And Collins was definitely one of those men. He was in that circle. I mean, he knew Pepys, the diarist, and he knew all of the monarchs, you know, of the time, you know, Charles II, James II, William
III. And of course,
III.
Pepys, now what was he in the dockyards? He was...
Well, Pepys was secretary to the Admiralty.
Yes, I knew he was doing something that's kind
something
of unexpected.
Something nautical, yeah, with the Navy, yes.
Yes.
And his wonderful collection of papers, you know, there are many references to Collins and his work as a hydrographic surveyor. So I think Collins has a lot to thank Pepys for getting
incredible
him the commission to do the survey.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Adrian, explain this wonderful chart you've brought in. Sorry, listeners, I know this is radio, but we're looking at a very long rectangular chart.
Sure. Well, this is quite an unusual chart. We think there may only be one other example of this in the world, and it actually covers part of the Polar Sea. And this is a chart that shows how Parry, who was our third hydrographer, charted his way towards the Northwest Passage, joining up the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans in the 1820s. And the chart was actually printed at the Admiralty Lithographic Press, not on the traditional copper plate that had been used for centuries. And we don't quite know why there's only one example of this in our archive. Sometimes there's multiple examples of printed charts, but it's possibly because not very many were actually printed, because it was done on lithography, and lithography soon became very unpopular because of the quality. But when we look closely, as Pauline very carefully spotted with her eagle eye earlier, there are some local connections, and there is, of course, North Somerset.
Yes.
Which is, of course,
which is
in
misleading
Canada.
Initially, which is in Canada. And we've got North Devon.
North Devon.
I mean, we've got Melville Island. These are terribly sort of English names. Radstock Bay.
Well, again, Radstock Somerset. Bay is after the family who were obviously quite important, the Waldegraves.
North Somerset.
Indeed. But the reason for the North Somerset connection is because Parry was born in Bath.
Uh-huh. So it's next to Bath.
And of course, obviously Bath was in Somerset in those days. And when they were sailing around these places, you can see that they were sort of running short of ideas
of
for
course.
Names of places, because nobody really from Great Britain had been this far north before.
Points on this chart, have these ports and locations kept these names?
Yes, many of them have.
Can I go to Radstock Bay now?
You probably could.
If I could.
You probably could.
Yes.
You can certainly go to Beachy Island.
Yes.
And
Gascoigne Inlet.
Yeah. I don't think really we could probably describe them as ports. This is very in the Arctic.
Yes, true. Yes, indeed. This is
but
cold
the headlands
and
will
remote.
Still be there. And
amazing.
It's really interesting when you look at the names. Mudge was he was in charge of the Ordnance Survey at that time, and there was also a hydrographic surveyor.
Yes.
And Bridport is after
Bridport Inlet.
The Hood family.
Hood, as in.
And of course, in the Admiralty, very important. And of course, Lady Gass at Fairfield is a descendant.
Mm.
And, you know.
I love this connection with now and then.
It's fantastic. Is. History lives
wonderful.
On.
Wonderful. Yes.
Goodness.
Yes. I mean, on first looks, it almost, you know, if you didn't look, it looks like the Bristol Channel, a bit not well sort of mapped. And you look at North Somerset thinking, and then you begin to stare and think, no, this is not Somerset. The names are similar, but the facts are different. That is fascinating. Thank you for bringing that in. And that is a wonderful document. And I do remember, I mean, before we finish it, because we're running out of time, I remember going on said visit and seeing a wonderful, wonderful chart which Bligh had made of his voyage when he was cast adrift. I mean, that's massive. Huge.
Absolutely incredible. And in the Admiralty Library, they had a 3-volume edition of Cook's voyages that were annotated by Bligh himself.
Really?
Yeah, in some very caustic comments that he made.
He was a very,
some of the charts.
Apparently sharp.
Very sharp, yeah. And we have other documents that relate to Bligh still in the archives in Taunton.
Oh, so much to see. May we do a visit next year, please?
I'll speak to our chief executive, Admiral Lowe, and I'm sure he'll say yes.
That would be lovely. Adrian, I'm sorry we've run out of time. We'll speak again, I know, but thank you very much for telling us the background, the very mobile background of the Hydrographic Office, and thank goodness we seem, at least for our time, to have secured it for Taunton for quite a while yet. So let's hope so.
Lovely.
Adrian, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Radio.